This is a podcast from wingsatliberty.com. Check out the wingsatliberty.com website, where you will find more information about issues related to flying birds, learning to train birds, and events offering experiences with flighted birds. This podcast is a free service supported by the folks at organicbirdfood.com, makers of Foundation Formula Pellets, Dynamo Sprout Mixes, and Merry Medley Seed Mixes. That's www.organicbirdfood.com. Please show your support by visiting organicbirdfood.com.
This is Alternate Perspective, a Wings at Liberty podcast where we discuss issues related to free flying birds. I'm Chris Bureau, and today I'm joined by author, parrot fancier, and breeder Steve Hartman. All right, microphone is on. And today I'm sitting here with Steve Hartman. And Steve Hartman is a breeder who's bred bird parrots for probably 20 years or so. I'll let you tell a little bit about yourself here and kind of fill us in on that. But today we're going to talk about what Steve has observed from breeding parrots and some of the developmental stages he's been able to witness with his system of observing chicks and their development and growth, and kind of how that'll impact parrots, in particular, how that might impact them as free flying candidates, and anything that Steve might have to throw in on that. Why don't you just go ahead and tell us a little bit about your background, just real quick?
Yeah, well, basically, we started 20 some years ago with the goal of selectively breeding parrots for pet purposes. So when you talk about what goes into a parrot and to get a desired effect like a bird that would free fly and do well in a confined environment as a routine, we can select for those traits, if we had enough time, very specifically by observing a lot of adult parrots and selecting for the adult parrots that already like to perform those behaviors. Most of them have a genetic predisposition that allow them to do certain things. In our case, what we're looking for is pet potential, so we look for parrots that have been in a pet situation. We basically know the history on, and the birds have thrived in the pet situation. We don't want to take a bird that doesn't want to live in a living room and have that bird contribute genetics to a genetic pool of birds that are supposed to live in the living room. Because for whatever reason that bird didn't work out, there's some genetic predisposition in that bird that allows it to get uncomfortable in that situation or get aggressive as it gets older. So we're on a very basic level trying to screen out the things that are really obvious. We can't do 100% level, we're not gene mapping anything, but we have good observing capabilities. We're educated observers, we've been doing it a lot. We've produced 4,000 babies now over a 20 some year period, and we've selected through 800 adults to get the 100 pairs that we have, and that's after we pre-selected for all of the birds that were available to begin with, thousands of birds, that we found 800 that we liked, and then out of the 800, we came up with perhaps 200 that we breed on a regular basis and that we think we've selected the proper genetics, or at least drifted the genetics in the right direction so that those offspring have a better chance of doing well in a home situation, given all of the constraints that we put on them that are not natural. Now, what we've also done is we've done multi-generation. So because we produce so many babies, these babies have gone out over the last 20 years, and for one reason or another, a lot of people have to get rid of their birds. We always assume that whoever gets that baby is probably going to be passing it on at some point for some reason. They die, they have a baby of their own, a human baby, they don't have time, they get divorced, they move, they retire, whatever. So we've been lucky with that number of babies over the years, knowing the history on the parents, knowing the babies, and then having a history of somebody else doing the experiment for us with taking that baby into their home. Some of them leave them flighted, some don't. We get that history on them. We can extrapolate a little bit about what caused the bird to exhibit certain behaviors. Basically, we select for the ones that did well regardless. And those birds we bring into our facility, and then we select from them over a period of years as they become adults. And we can look at them and see how well they do in a flock behavior. We know how well they did in a home behavior or home environment. And then in the flock, they need to develop flock awareness, flock etiquette. They need to understand bird body language. And we can observe that develop over a couple year period, and we basically see how well they work and play with individuals similar to themselves. So we have a pet history, and then we have a flock bird history that we can use. And each generation, we expect that we are selecting a little bit better and shifting the genetics just a tiny bit, not a lot. We're not making great strides here. It'll be 20, 30 generations till we get a really good pet parent is equivalent to a really good puppy,
right,
that we can expect to grow up into a good pet dog.
But you've made pretty good progress already in getting birds that are highly social and seem to be better at being in social environments.
Definitely. And in a lot of the species, we're up to the fourth generation where we've seen this, from one generation to the other. And we do have a lot of people around here, a lot of volunteers that are really tuned into the psyche of each bird. And they know these birds and they know the pet situation. And they can actually, which totally amazes me, they can walk into a flock of 20 greenwings and they know who is related to who. And they can tell just by the behavior of those birds. Or they can even tell by the look of the bird, because they all look different to each other, just like we look different to each other. I can't do it, but I'm lucky to have all these people around here that have that ability to do that. So it's not just myself that's doing the selecting process. It's a huge number of people over the years, maybe hundreds of people altogether, with all the vet students that have been involved, looking at different traits, different mechanisms of behavior and cause and effect of the environment. The shift that we've made may be significant. We sort of downplay it to maybe 1 or 2%, but the reality may be greater. We may have done a better job than we know. One thing that we're not doing is we're not seeing the birds for 50 years. And how are they going to get as they start to get older and become geriatric? Are they still going to make a good pet? So those things we don't know, but we've at least got four generations on things like greenwings and umbrella cockatoos, which most people in the industry would say that's not possible. We've been able to do it with birds that we actually select for not breeding. The birds that we select, when we select the behaviors that do well in the living room, we exclude any good breeding behavior. Breeding birds are aggressive birds.
You mean generally that's the way breeding gets done, is by selecting birds that are not good in the living room, and then those birds are the ones typically that get bred.
Right. Yeah, they tend to get aggressive, they tend to get territorial, they have a high testosterone or estrogen level. So those birds are good candidates for breeding. They're not good candidates for the living room. But if you take those birds and if you take 100 blue and gold macaws and put them in 100 different living rooms, and then you select out the 80 that don't work out and use those to breed your next generation.
Keep that up very long.
Yeah, pretty soon, right now already, you're seeing a case, what I believe is, and I can't quantify or qualify this specifically, but I think we're seeing birds that are getting more aggressive because we're selecting for aggression. And
inadvertently, but nonetheless, that is what we're doing.
Well-intentioned people thinking that they're doing something positive, but not understanding the science behind it. They don't have a genetic background, a biology background. And in most cases, they don't have any science background, certainly not on a collegiate level where they have developed the ability to be an educated observer. And so you can pretty much expect that as time goes on, because the industry only breeds in general, only breeds the birds that nobody would want. If it's a case of a dog, you had a dog that became aggressive and bit the neighbors and wouldn't behave and was too vocal, you would euthanize it and you would not turn that into a breeder, hopefully. But in the parrot world, the most aggressive bird gets the greatest opportunity to breed. If you have a baby that's aggressive by the time it's a year old, it goes to a breeder pretty quickly.
Right.
So the day that it's reproductively mature, it's already got a mate and it's producing babies.
That's sweet. Pet, though, on the other hand, is staying in somebody's home much longer.
Right. Those 20 out of the 100 that might have good pet potential may never get an opportunity to breed.
Right.
So we've been lucky that we've been able to get a large group of birds that, because we're big enough and it requires being large and having a big influence in the industry, because of that we've been able to get these birds back. People know what we're doing, so when they do have a bird that they think might be a good candidate, they want it to come live here. A lot of people, when they have a bird that they have to take out of a home situation for one reason or another, they generally want it to go to another home. But once somebody visits here and sees the place, sees what it's like and the level of care, oftentimes they would rather the bird come here, where it has the chance of living in a big cage and flying free out in the big, flying free as far as you can in a cage. But
well, they're big cages.
They're large cages, and they have a good life. So we actually have people that want their birds to come here if they can't take care of themselves, right, which is contrary to the average situation.
And actually, you're probably contrary to the average situation as well, because you're interested in bringing those birds back in some cases. Most breeders aren't looking to get their birds back.
Right, yeah. Most breeders aren't. And we have certain bloodlines. In fact, here recently, we have some bloodlines that we think are so significant. We have some double yellowheads. Amazons are probably the most aggressive birds when they're breeding. If you walk next to an Amazon cage, they're going to be on the wire trying to eat you through the wire. The tamest bird as a pet, as soon as it becomes a breeder as an Amazon, is going to be aggressive like that. We have double yellowhead Amazons that you can pretty much get into the nest box when they've got babies, and they won't bother you. They'll just move over. Those birds, we never get their babies back. We've got other species like that where we've actually, in just the last few years, we've had to actually keep babies back because we're afraid we're going to lose that genetic line. So we don't have the proof from seeing all those babies come back and then reintroduce them to the flock, but we know that all of those babies that they produce have never come back. So there must be something going on that's keeping them in the pet situation more so than the other line. So that's something we never intended to do, and our policy was never to keep back babies. And some breeders, they think they're doing something special by keeping back successive generations, and that's great if you're just trying to keep a species alive. We're not in the conservation business. We're in the pet bird business. That's what we're producing, is a pet bird that's going to love to live in your living room for the rest of its life. No intention ever of going back into the wild.
So of course, if you were to take that same group of birds, though, and put them back into a breeding situation where they were able to select out with other birds not that have gone through your selection criteria, within a very short time, those would go back to, the babies would go back to being...
Yeah, that's correct.
Standard...
Yeah, and the reason is that we're just doing subtle selections. The majority of the genetics are still there, 99.999%. And the other bird that has the aggression, you may not need both genes from both parents to express that behavior.
Right.
And there might be multiple genes involved in a particular behavior, and different environmental switches turn different ones on. So as soon as you stop aggressively selecting for a certain behavior, you have the potential for it to quickly revert back.
Right.
It wouldn't be the case of, like, if you had a couple of Cocker Spaniels, they're not going to become wolves overnight, but the parrots are not that far removed from their pure genetic lines, so very quickly, a couple of generations, even with our fourth generation birds, they would be basically a wild bird.
So you've also done a lot of observing the birds as chicks and
right.
and observing their behavior and cataloging and creating notes and records of some of the developmental things you've observed starting at an early age.
Yeah, the first thing we look for is the genetic contribution from the parents. And then we have the birds breed from the time they lay the egg and until the time the egg hatches. There's not a whole lot of contribution from anywhere going on. It's just an incubating egg. But we found by having all of our video cameras in the nest boxes over the years and being able to watch 24 hours a day with the 6 monitors we have in the office, we see exactly what happens in the nest box. And we noticed early on that when the chick would start to pip internally in the egg, and generally kind of Macaulay, it's a 28-day hatching cycle, the last 3 days, the baby is pipped internally into the interior of the egg and starting to become an air-respiring animal. As soon as it starts to do that and its lungs start to work, it starts vocalizing. They're just subtle little vocalizations, but you can hear them. We can even hear them on the microphone that's on the camera on the end of the nest box, so it's loud enough that we can even hear it in the office where we're watching this. And as soon as the parents hear the sound, they start paying attention to that egg. They've been sitting on it for 25 days, just sitting on it, getting up and turning them around or what's on. Now there's some feedback coming. They're hearing a sound, and they go over there and they rub their beak on the egg, and they start to actually make sounds. You know, I can't reproduce it. I'm not a nurturing mom kind of thing, but they definitely communicate with that baby. And as the baby develops over those last 3 days, it becomes very vocal inside the shell. And the last day, it's just as vocal as if it's out of the shell. The baby is also in the shell turning around, trying to pip internally and pip the egg and break the end off. The parents watch that. Every time that baby moves in there, it's just like the baby, a human baby in an abdomen, and the mother feeling the baby kick. As soon as the mother feels the baby kick, she puts her hand on the belly, and that gives feedback to the baby, the human fetus. It's happening the same way in the shell, with the parents giving feedback to that baby. Now, if the neurodevelopment is starting, significantly starting, 3 days before hatch, we already have vocalization and feedback from the parents. You get not only vocal, but you get tactile stimulation from the shell being touched by the beak raking across it. The parents are going to be turning them more because they're being prompted from the egg to pay attention to it. Then as the baby makes more noise and tries to get out of the shell, the parents spend a lot of time communicating with that baby, paying attention to it. When that little tiny chip of the shell moves and the parents start pulling on it and playing with it, you know, just sort of almost like they're helping the baby. They don't aggressively help. They don't take the end off. It's not, I don't know if they know what they're doing, but they're not going to break in. They're waiting for the baby to come out, but they're assisting almost in like pulling up that little flap so they can sort of look in maybe, you know, or hear a little better.
Curiosity.
Curiosity, just playing. All of that is a huge amount of feedback. If the baby is not in the nest with the parents and it's just in an incubator, it's missing all of that neurostimulation. So if the neural pathways are starting to develop significantly at 3 days before hatch in the wild, we take that egg and put it into an incubator, it has none of that stimulation. So,
oh, like it's basically the hum of a fan.
Right, and that's probably a negative thing. We haven't done any studies on it, but we know different frequencies of sound and motion cause all kinds of havoc on humans.
Especially repetitive things that are not producing some kind of a feedback with the environment, but just a constant hum or constant
Definitely.
Noise.
So we did not incubate eggs. And then we had a period where we were doing study on eggs. And we, for a couple of years, incubated quite a few, and then we filmed the development inside of the egg. And as we started to accumulate information, we decided that there's no way that we will ever produce a baby that isn't hatched in a nest, because there's so much neurodevelopment that occurs in those first few days that we think that it might even be as significant as like 5 or 10% of the total IQ of the bird, ultimately, because those 3 days, if it's exponential development, and 2 times 2 is 4, etc., you've got a significant amount that's missed. And because we know that so many of the stimulus has to be provided at the sensitive period, that period isn't exposed, and that data never gets fed in and processed.
It's a critical, what we call critical periods. And then it's not just the 3 days prior to hatch. Of course, once the chick hatches, then the parents continue to stimulate it, unlike what happens in a artificial incubator type of hatching.
Right. Yeah, when we watch the babies in the nest, it's amazing how much work the parents do, how much the work the father does. We never could figure out why our nest boxes were always clean for the first couple weeks. When the babies were in there, you would think they would be a mess. They're eating liquidy formula or, you know, food from the parents, and there'd be poop everywhere, and the shavings weren't even dirty. You didn't even have to find, you know, a single shaving that was dirty in most cases. And watching the birds on the monitor, we'd see the father come in, and the father would be turning the baby over, flipping it over on its back, and then manipulating the cloaca on the baby, actually with its tongue and its beak. And the baby was defecating. The male was actually, his job was to clean up. He ate the feces and stimulated the baby to defecate. After a couple of weeks, that's a pretty big job, and they lose interest, I think.
Like, well, I'm glad we don't have to do it that way.
Most of us males would lose interest a lot faster.
A lot quicker.
But it is a significant amount of influence that the male has on that chick, getting moved around, knocked over. If you think just the balance that the baby's developing in the first 3 days in the nest with the male coming in and turning it over and then getting it back upright, in the container in the incubator, or in a brooder, once the baby's hatched, it gets none of that. There's no push and pull on the baby. If the baby falls over in the incubator, it's not being touched by anything else. It's not falling over as a response of being touched. It's not even being supported as a response of something moving it.
And all that, of course, is stimulus that its little brain is responding to.
Developing the cerebellum. So you're talking about flight. Your specialty is free flight. And if we want a bird that, regardless of what our selecting behavior or breeding selection for the ultimate use of the bird, like in pet situation, if the cerebellum isn't developed properly, starting at, you know, early on, that bird's going to have less of an ability, slightly less, not huge, but slightly less, of ability to perform in the air and avoid predators and feel confident. You know, every parrot that flies outside is the equivalent of what I consider being an Olympic athlete in human terms. In the wild, almost all of them die the first year, and only the really successful ones, or lucky ones, survive. In your case, you're keeping them alive, you're supplementing them a little bit, but even then, to develop that fine motor skill and awareness is what we call thinking on the wing.
Right. And that's a really critical part of the type of flying that we do. A lot of people fly birds, they think of themselves as flying birds. You think of a zoo, for instance, or a theme park show where the bird's going to fly in, swooping in over the top of the audience and land on the stage. And certainly that qualifies as flying. But the thinking on the wing, that bird doesn't have to do that. Right. Our birds, because of the way we do fly them, they're out from 8 o'clock in the morning until sundown and every day, and they're responsible for taking care of themselves. So that thinking on the wing is really important.
Yeah, the zoo birds are a one-dimensional thing. They have a point A to point B, and usually everything is controlled in between. They do their stunt, and that's done. Your birds have to actually process vision, sound, predator avoidance, all at the same time, multiple things, multiple bodily functions.
Yeah, I've seen my guys outfly hawks roughly about 30 times that I've personally witnessed it. Yeah. I don't know how many times they've done it that I haven't seen it, but
yeah.
I've been around and seen it about 30 times or so.
Yeah. In a wild situation, if you had the same number of incubator hatched as parent reared or hatched in the nest babies that were released, given, you know, all the perils that are in the wild and the weather conditions and everything, I would be highly suspect that hardly any of the ones that were hatched in an incubator would actually thrive and survive long term, just because that period at the beginning is so critical.
And we know it's critical, not just because of observing the pet parrot qualities that you're working on, but also because science, with a great deal of research in other species, has been able to document and establish that those first few weeks, depends upon the species, of course, first few days, first few weeks, first few months, have very lifelong shaping effect on those little animals as they are developing.
Yeah, we figure that probably 2 weeks is what, for our purposes, a pet situation. First 2 weeks in the nest, hatching in the nest and then living 2 weeks in it with the parents, is incredibly critical. The parents can give the baby exactly what the baby needs. We can't. Even though we can get them alive in the brooder, we can actually make more survive. We can have a higher survival rate because we're not accidentally stepping on them, or one getting too cold, or getting a bacterial infection in the brooder. We can make a sterile environment.
Right.
Of course, that's not good for the long-term health of the baby, but we can keep it alive. So we can actually do a higher survival rate, but those babies on average are not going to thrive as well. So we look at the first 2 weeks as very critical. After that, you start to get to the point where we can do a pretty good job in the nursery. Not the same as the parents by any means, but for our purposes of pet, we give it the first 2 weeks. That gets the brain set up, so that then everything else can thrive as the baby develops. Without that first 2 weeks, we're at a great disadvantage trying to raise a parrot properly.
So this is interesting because there's a new push right now, and some states have signed on to this that make it illegal to sell unweaned babies. I have for some time argued that that's maybe not in the best interest of the bird because the new owner is likely to be the person to give that bird the most attention, whereas many breeders simply aren't going to give, they have many birds, and they're simply not going to have the time to spend that the new owner would have, giving right. that bird that personal attention.
Yeah, the one-on-one attention is very important. And what we do here, and we've done this with 4,000 babies, we've never sold a weaned baby, and we never will, hopefully. They'll always be spoken for long before that. The owner will know the bird before it leaves here, or a lot of times they're on a waiting list before the baby is born, sometimes years. And then at the time when the baby would be getting out of the nest in the wild, so they had a macaw size, 8 weeks, 9 weeks, somewhere around there, and they'd be getting out, going back in. At the time when they start to fly, that first week, we like to have them here. They're starting to need a lot of one-on-one attention, but we leave them here for the first week because we want them to get the basic flying skills down here under our guidance, because we know we have windows in the nursery, have you seen, and mirrors. We can develop some awareness of windows and mirrors and just basic flying skills in our controlled environment and with our knowledge of what they're going to do and how they're going to do it. Then when they go to the owner's house, when they've been flying for 1 week, they're still going to crash into things, but they've already developed some of the motor skills, and it doesn't take them very long to figure out what all the windows are in that house. A couple days, and they've got it down. Same with mirrors and all the other obstacles.
And actually, during this phase of their development, this is when they're identifying and defining, actually, what normal is.
Yeah.
And so this is actually a really critical part of their life, to be identifying the environment that they are going to be living in.
Yeah. So you think of it as the terrible twos in human stage, which is actually, I think, in humans, from the time we start to crawl, we're actually pretty terrible for our parents to follow us around. But that's an important phase for us to freely explore our environment. So we crawl around, we get into trouble, we got mom following behind us. In the parrot world, at that time when that baby gets out of the nest, that's when that awareness of the environment, the socialization starts, all of the things that you push for proper development to get your birds out into the public.
Right, that's when I want them, because that's when I want them developing as many of those natural skills and natural species-specific behaviors that we can get that started.
Yeah.
But we want a good foundation for the birds to build on, recognizing what normal is. I don't want them to come from a brooder type of situation where they've been fed in a somewhat boring and sterile environment. By boring, I mean they're typically in a special room for without a lot of stimulus in there. I prefer them to be actually seeing the environment for which they're going to be starting to fly in, and mm-hmm. getting to know what that environment's going to be, so they are becoming aware of the things to be identified as normal and the things to be identified as not normal.
Yeah. So if they're in a home, the mother's, the owner's following them around the house, be it a male or female, they're still the mother figure, the parent figure. And the baby's doing all of the same kind of things that we do. He's flying into walls, running into walls, pulling things off the table, getting into trouble. But basically what he's doing is freely exploring his environment and learning everything that he touches. When you're talking about states that have enacted laws where you can't sell a weaned baby, what they're doing is becoming reactionary to problems within the industry, where most of the breeders are small breeders, are not professionals, well-intentioned, but a lot of them just don't have the skills. They haven't done thousands of babies. And I tell you, the first 500 I did, even though we did a really good job, I know that they're not nearly the same as the last 3,500. So you have a situation where you have breeders are having problems, and then they can't properly educate the owner to finish weaning that baby. We've done 4,000 at least, and only a couple, I mean, I'm talking two, maybe five, that didn't work out. And it's not that difficult. It's very easy. But we know how to do it. We're professionals at educating the owners and providing them with the information and the backup to take care of that baby properly. The well-intentioned government is reacting to these individuals that are having problems. They're reporting that it's a difficult thing to do because it is difficult for them because they don't know what they're doing. Right. So they think that if they can't do it, then nobody else should be able to do it. Where the reality is that there are people that do it really well without any problems. And if they would just adopt those policies, then you wouldn't have all these problems.
And what's not being considered in the debate at all is the effect that it's actually going to have on the chicks, on the birds themselves, as far as their development goes. That part's never been entered into the discussion.
Yeah, the average small breeder, even if they've only produced, say, 20 birds a year, at any one time, they're going to have 4, 5, 6, 10 babies in the house. And the first thing that they do as soon as those babies become mobile is clip the wings, because there's no way that they can deal
with 20
same as
babies.
With 10 2-year-old kids in your house. You can't deal with it. You have to lock them up in cribs.
Right.
And that's basically what happens to the birds. They get locked into a cage almost all the time because, one person, how can they spend that much time with that many babies? They can't. So they spend almost no time getting socialized, freely exploring their environment. Almost all of them have their wings clipped. It's very rare for those type of breeders, the smaller breeders, to have fully flighted birds. So the birds aren't developing a full complement of senses because they're not flying. And they're basically not developing. And you're missing all those critical periods. Then as an adult, you expect them to be able to behave, to be a highly functional individual, to have a high IQ, and you've never educated them. So it's not possible. In our case, I'm sure that there are many birds that go out of here, go into a home situation, and the people leave them in a cage and never get them out, never play with them, and they don't develop properly. But the people are able to wean them without any problem. Actually, the bird weans itself. All you got to do is feed it, and that's not an issue. There are some birds that we produce that are not going to work out just like other ones, but not because of the weaning process. It's because most humans have not seen babies birds raised over the period of years, all of their life, like dogs. We all know how to take care of a dog, even if we've never had one before. We have a pretty good idea what to expect. We know that they're supposed to bite the mailman and those kind of things. With a parrot, you don't know what to expect, so you do have a lot of people that don't do a good job just because they're not intuitive as what to do.
Right. And would you say that you've seen, can you think of some kind of example that would maybe give an idea of maybe a developmental difference this way, or what kind of impact this has on a parrot? In other words, is this critical period, is there something that missing this critical period that you can say, how you relate that to a pet bird who's missed that critical period as compared to a wild bird, for instance?
Yeah, there's
or
a couple
a bird
things.
That's been raised properly.
Yeah, there's a couple of things. One, we know that wild birds normally don't bite each other. They have a concern over their personal distance from anything, so they don't want anything to touch them. For them to be biting and aggressive in captivity is a totally abnormal behavior for them. If they're not able to freely explore their environment and to become confident, then they're not going to be able to work things out in new social situations as they come along. So if you have a 3-4-month-old young blue and gold macaw, say, and the bird is not allowed to fly, let's say the wings are clipped, and maybe it's in a small breeder operation where it's in the house, people come into the house, the bird's clipped because they can't handle a bunch of flighted birds, and somebody comes close to the bird is not able to retreat and approach, which is very important for all animals, to be able to retreat from a new stimulus, observe, decide that it's okay to approach, and then get back into the situation and actually get something out of the social situation or even an interaction with, you know, another animal or another object coming into the room, a new lamp coming into the room. If the bird hasn't had enough situations where it's been able to retreat and approach from something new, it's going to develop a phobia of everything that's new.
So which, of course, we see in plenty of pet birds.
Oh, yeah, lots of them. I hear people all the time, they can't buy a new piece of furniture because their bird is going to go nuts. And that's, I mean, if we had a situation where every time somebody built a new house or put in a telephone pole, birds would be extinct in the wild.
Of course.
And so these are totally atypical behaviors that are developing out of a compromised environmental situation.
Another one probably would be object permanence, the ability to track an object once it a moving object that disappears from your sight temporarily.
Yeah.
And then be able to continue to track that object.
Right. Yeah, one thing we were talking about the other day was when somebody, if somebody buys a puppy and a parrot the same day, by the end of the first day, they can hide in any closet in the house and that puppy can find them. But most parrots have no idea 20 years later where that person would be, even if they're just on the other side of the door, right there next to the parrot.
Right.
And that's because their wings are clipped or they're raised in an environment where they can't freely explore. And they don't develop that.
And of course, in the wild, they would have an extensive ability to explore, and not just explore, but to map their environment.
Right.
We have certain areas of our brain that perform mapping functions, mapping for our own personal space, our body, all of our functions, where your hands and fingers are. But also, there are parts of the brain that map the location that you live in and the areas that you work in. That's how you can find your way back and forth to places.
Yeah.
Never had the ability to develop those skills, then once they get loose outside accidentally, then how would we possibly expect them to find their way back?
Right, yeah. The wild birds aren't dropping breadcrumbs to find their way home at night.
Right.
And the one thing that, you know, if you talk to people and ask them what bird or what animal could you expect that could go, you know, 1,000 miles and come back to the same spot every year, it would be a bird.
Right.
Yet the average pet bird owner expects that if their bird gets on the other side of the front door, it's gone. And because it has no navigation skills, it has no ability to understand where it's at.
Well, it's not just about navigational skills. It actually turns out that there are sections of the brain that develop to do this mapping function.
Mm-hmm.
It is, yes, I'm sure the skills are directly related to the mapping function of the brain. And again, there are different parts of the brain that perform this function, but those parts of the brain have to be developed in order to be used.
Right.
Can't develop the skills without the parts of the brain to do it.
Yeah, parrots are like humans a lot. A lot of the programs have to be developed. They're not like some other animals like snakes or even dogs don't have to develop nearly as much of their instinctive behavior, what we call instinctive behavior. It's there when they're born. But parrots have what I call the innate learned. They have the basic program, but it needs to be developed. It needs to be installed.
Well, just like it's natural for humans to be able to walk, it's also natural for humans to have to learn how to walk. You
right.
don't just come with those automatically functioning. It's a species-specific behavior across humans. We are recognized as being able to walk. That's a phylogenetic behavior. But nonetheless, we had to learn how to walk.
Right.
And there's a learning process involved with many phylogenetic behaviors.
Mm-hmm. You know, parrots have to learn how to fly. We know that it takes them a week just to be able to get around the room well. They don't start out just flying well. You would think the veterinarians and the people that are concerned about them getting hurt for some reason seem to think that they should jump out of the egg and fly without any problem. But we know that it doesn't take them very long, and they're very rubbery, just like we are when we're kids. So with having basically over 4,000 birds fledge here, we've had only one issue that I know of where a bird broke a bone. We've had some bloody beaks from hitting windows and things, but certainly not the incidences that I went through as a kid, breaking bones and getting stitches and stuff. We had one bird that flew into the sink in the nursery. As they start to fly in our nursery, we encourage them to fly to us just like they would fly to their parents if they wanted to eat. So when we're feeding them at the sink, they fly in. We had one fly in a little bit low, and hit its leg on the edge of the sink. And they do this all the time. This one happened to break a leg. It was repaired, but in general, they're very rubbery, they bounce really well, and they learn very quickly.
Well, they learn fast. There's no doubt about that. Those exploration flights develop fairly quickly. I call the first flights desperation flights because the bird is desperate to get from here to there, has very limited control. But after a short period, you can see starting to get some confidence and some faith in his control. And at that point, he's willing to start exploring his environment.
Yeah, there's something that we observe. I don't know if you wanted to get into this, but I'm going to tell you anyways because it's an interesting story. We're down in the nursery, and as I said, all of our birds learn to fly. And it's always a surprise to them the first time they fly. They have no idea that they can fly. They don't even know what it's all about. But it almost happens almost always right after we fed them. When we walk into the room, they're all intent on getting fed, and they're focused on that. So if they're mobile at all, they're crawling across the other cages and stuff to get to the sink. But as soon as they've eaten, they'll go and they'll stand up somewhere and they'll start flapping their wings and exercising. And as they do this more and more over a several day period, they're lifting off more and more. They're still holding on, but they're almost like they're going to lift up the cage. Mm-hmm. And then one day they let go. And it's like, oh shit, what the hell? And then they're flying across the room, because as soon as they lift off, then they start to dive down, then they're going faster. And they fly across the room, and they have some ability to avoid, not much. And they always get to the farthest corner of the room. And they hit the wall. And they hit it every time. We put them back. Now, this is where most of the conflict comes in and people clip the wings. We call it our rule of five. The bird flies off the first time and hits the corner. And then maybe that day, probably the next day, the bird's going to do the exact same thing again, and he's going to go to the exact same spot. And at first, I didn't understand what was going on, and I thought, you know, just like everybody else, the birds are too stupid to learn how to avoid a wall. Well, what you find if you let this behavior happen, and we've seen it with 4,000 babies now, it happens exactly the same, almost the exact same spot on the wall every time for every bird. And you can look down in there in a couple of weeks as these birds start to learn to fly, you'll see food and feces in the same spot on the wall where they hit and make a mess. The second time they fly towards it, and they're going to hit it, but you can see, if you watch them, we've got cameras down there, we've actually filmed them, you can just see a glimmer of, oh, I did it again. And then they hit the wall. Now the third time, they know they're going to hit it. They don't know when they leave, but when they're most of the way there, they know they're going to hit, and they start to deviate a little bit. Fourth time, they're able to deviate, but they still hit the wall, and they slide off and hit somewhere. The fifth time, they can land on the cage next to it. The fifth time, when they leave the point where they started to fly, they don't know what they're doing. But by the time they go that 10 or 12 feet across the room, they've already calculated in enough, and this is only after a couple of days, to deviate and fly and land somewhere else. Not real well, but five times. And it takes five times for almost every behavior that we observe. Now, you might ask, why do they fly to the same spot? Well, if they flew to a different spot, they'd have to be learning something totally different.
Correct.
So they always fly to the same spot. They always do those same kind of behaviors over and over again. Five times for all the different behaviors that we see. When they're learning windows, we have the window hanging right in the middle of the nursery. And we know they're going to hit it. And they hit it, and some of them hit it hard. But
well, of course, they're not going to hit it real hard because the nursery's not a big room, so
right.
They can't get up a lot of speed.
Yeah, we don't do it in a 30-foot wide room. It's the window's in the middle, so you're talking maybe 8 feet at the most. But still, from an average person thinking that the bird's going to die when it hits a window or something, it sounds like it is. But the reality is it's not. Every once in a while, you can see them on the windowsill. We have a big window cylinder, and you can see them standing there shaking their head like, wow, that hurt. But it only takes them 3 days. 72 hours is all it takes for any bird to learn what a window is. And the mirror's in the same way. Down there, at first you see them looking in the mirror, or they get startled when they see another bird fly in the mirror. And at 72 hours, they know that other bird flying across the room that they can see in the mirror is not a threat to them. And they know to avoid the mirrors. By the time the bird's been flying here a week in the nursery, it goes to somebody else's house. It'll hit their mirrors and windows, but they already know the concept, and it takes them only a few minutes to figure it out. People that put all the drapes over the windows and put all the camouflage on it, don't let the bird see them for a year. Then the bird runs into the window with a hard, fixed skeleton, and it gets hurt.
Right, and with the ability to pick up some speed because the size of the room.
That's right.
They need to learn about those windows and those mirrors before they get into that environment where they can get that much speed built up.
Yeah. So while they're rubbery, they bounce off everything, and they will. Some of them will get hurt. Luckily, we have very few get hurt, but that's also a risk of life. Life has inherent dangers, and one of the ways you learn is to get hurt.
Right.
And unfortunately, there are some fatalities, I'm sure. We don't have any real experience with them, but I'm sure there are. But in general, the bird has a much fuller life. It's a much better pet. It's a much more confident pet if it learns how to fly, if it's had those advantages. If it's a flying juvenile and it's not locked in a cage, that means somebody is following it around. And in a lot of cases, in our birds, since every bird leaves with a harness, a lot of them are going out of the house and they're getting experience with the harness. So the birds are flighted and they've got somebody with them all the time. You know, as many hours a day as these people possibly can.
And it's actually quite a fun experience to have a baby bird like that and watch it and go through this developmental process. And the fun factor of that attracts the person to spend more time with it. And I've heard it said that, we don't want our babies becoming dependent on that amount of attention that they're getting. So you actually want to give them less attention. And that, I find, from my own experience, is completely not the case. You cannot give a baby bird enough attention. And if you do, if you think you're overdoing it, you just wait a little while, and at some point they're going to hit an adolescent phase, just like a human child does, and they're going to say, okay, I'm ready to go do my own thing a little bit here, back off. So even if you do give them a lot of attention, you are certainly not... I don't think you can give them too much attention because you don't have to worry about them becoming fixated on you because you gave them attention. That's an old wives' tale.
We run into that question a lot. There's a lot of people out there who say, don't pet your bird because it's going to expect it. And those kind of things drive me nuts because if you think of it in terms of a human, forget the bird for a minute. If you have a human and you take two of us, you and me, one of us is educated and one of us isn't. We don't get the attention from our parents. We don't get the schooling. We just don't get educated. As an adult, the more educated person can deal with stresses and reductions in life experience a lot easier because you can think it through. You can understand it a little better. And you can also self-entertain and self-stimulate. Birds that don't get a lot of attention, that don't get played with by the owner, don't know how to play with toys. They're not as good at it. They can't self-stimulate themselves all day long. They get bored faster. They're crankier. They're brats. Where the bird that is well-educated and has lots of stimulus from the parent can spend a lot more time alone without the parent, and which will happen as the bird gets older. At first, there's a big attraction to the baby and a lot of time spent. As things go on, other things happen, and the bird spends more time in the cage, or some people have a big room for them, but they do have more time alone generally. And the more educated bird is going to be able to deal with that much better than the one that didn't get the education.
And so that education comes from the interaction. The time and the tactile and the social interaction that comes with just basically playing and enjoying a baby bird like that. There's a lot of mental stimulation, neural processes are being developed. There's a lot going on there.
And another thing that bothers me is if this person that's getting this bird is thinking that they're not going to give the bird stimulation later on, why do they have the bird?
You know, quite true.
If you're not going to provide the optimal circumstances for the bird, then you shouldn't have the bird to begin with.
Agreed. Agreed. Well, this has been interesting. We're going to have to do this again here. And again, Steve Hartman and Chris Bureau here. And I look forward to getting together with you again and doing this some more.
Yeah, great. We've got a few more topics to discuss.
I'm sure we'll get to them.
All right, great. Thanks, Chris.
If you have questions or comments about something you heard during this podcast, please contact me through the Wings at Liberty website. That is www.wingsatliberty.com. Special thanks to Steve Hartman, Judy Hartman, and Susan Hilliard for their support in helping make this podcast happen. I'm Chris Biro, and thanks for joining us.
This has been a podcast from wingsatliberty.com. This podcast was produced by Chris Biro, all rights reserved.